This is All of It. I'm Kushan Avadar in for Allison Stewart. Hey, thanks for spending part of your beautiful Tuesday with us. I'm so glad you're here. On today's show, we'll speak with author Layla Motley about her new collection of poetry. We'll learn about the world of dog shows from Pulitzer Prize finalist Tommy Tomlinson, and we'll explore a new exhibit at the New York Historical Society called Lost New York, and we're going to take your calls about places you remember in the city. That's the plan, so let's get this party started with author Amor Towles. You know author Amor Towles for his novels Rules of Civility, A Gentleman in Moscow, and The Lincoln Highway. And now you can read some short stories that Towles has written over the last decade. His new short story collection is called Table for Two, and they include six stories set in New York City, mostly around the turn of the millennium. And if you're a fan of Towles' first novel, Rules of Civility, I've got some good news for you. This collection also includes a novella that follows Eve Ross, the mysterious and charismatic character who disappeared abruptly in the original story. Eve is in a new chapter of life working around Hollywood in the late 1930s. Table for Two is available now, and by the way, a TV adaptation of A Gentleman in Moscow is also currently streaming on Paramount Plus. So with me to talk about his work is author Amor Towles. Amor, welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning, Kusha. It's great to be back.
It's great to have you. Let's talk about the short stories. You developed them over the last 10 years, but most of them are set right around the turn of the millennium, you know, late 90s, early 2000s. What was it about this setting for you?
I tend to write my short stories in between the novels. I really need to have a lot of dedicated time and open runway to do a novel. So in between the novels, while I'm, let's say, on tour, I'll slide in some stories. And it just seems like a very natural format to study my own times. I've written a lot of books about set in different periods. I'm not against setting a novel in the current period, but it's been fun to use the short stories as a way of sort of picking at the New York that I've witnessed firsthand.
Oh, so it was the fact that for you firsthand means late 90s, early 2000s in that period, right?
Yes, I've lived in the city since the late 80s. So yeah, this is a part of the period in which I've lived. That's right.
And let's talk about short stories for a second, because I love reading short stories, and especially being able to see novelists and authors jump between the two. Have short stories always been a format that you've loved? Did you start writing fiction short stories? How do they help you prepare for like the longer novels?
Yes, I began writing fiction as a kid, and I think like many novelists, I started with the short story because it's a great vehicle in which to try to master various elements of craft. Because that from story to story to story, you can approach setting differently. You can approach the thematic quality differently, the poetics differently, the structure differently, the point of view differently. So the stories really provide you an opportunity to explore the different ways in which you are going to, the different tools you're going to use to tell stories in the longer form of the novel.
What about writing a short story is harder than a novel, though?
I think I don't know if this is going to be harder, but I think a major difference between the novel and the short story, from my point of view, is that in the novel, consciously or unconsciously, an author has to do a lot to orient the reader. If you go back and look at the first 30 pages of any novel you like, there's a lot of information there about the time it's set in, the place it's set in, the characters and their backgrounds, all as a means of sort of laying the groundwork so that the reader can then go into the adventure of the novel on firm footing. And in a short story, you do not have the time for that kind of orientation. You drop right in. So, you know, and that's a pleasure for the writer to some degree, and it's a pleasure for the reader, I think, where suddenly there's a conversation between a husband and wife, and you're like, wait, what happened? Wait, are they married? You know, somebody said something, you know, why are they fighting? You know, what year is this? You know, are we in Chicago? Are we in Miami? Where are we? And so you're in the course of the story, you're piecing together where you are, but even as you're reading it and figuring that out, you realize you're running out of space. You know, there's only six pages left. There's only four pages left. Because you're only going to get a glimpse. And that's part of the pleasure of the short story is that you're getting a glimpse into someone's life. You have to sort of launch yourself into it, look around as quickly as you can, interpret everything as best you can, and you leave it, in essence, the feeling like a few minutes later, but with a sense that something important has happened in the lives of these individuals.
Have you ever watched, experienced improv before?
We've all inherited sort of the tradition of improv through Saturday Night Live and all the other formats now, but yes, I have.
Because it's just such an interesting comparison to that art form where there's long form and short form improv, like Whose Line Is It Anyway? I think of as short form, and in that one, it really teaches you the structure of story where the economy of time, which I hear you talking
exactly
about.
Exactly right.
Yeah, exactly. Like, where are you, who are you to each other, et cetera, et cetera.
And I think, you know, one of the fun things about a short story is that if you think of a novel where you've got over 100,000 words, say in my novels, the last sentence might be beautiful. It might be important. It might be, you know, it might sort of hit the perfect ending. But it is sort of lost within the giant woods that is the novel. In a short story, a last sentence can sort of completely change the way that you've read the story. It can spin it around. And so that you could be reading through the story and say, oh yes, this is about the wife. And I can see what's happening to her and what she's thinking and whatever, as the husband sort of relates some event that occurred. And in the final sentence, you can suddenly stop and be like, wait a second, the story was about him, you know, and it changes everything that you've done, you know, and that's a fun thing about a short story too, is that you can shift very rapidly the orientation for the reader in terms of how they assume what the story is about, from what perspective it's being told. Whereas in the novel, you don't have the freedom to do that.
Have you ever had a plan to do that and actually seen it executed, like from vision before you started writing? Or is that the kind of thing where really at the end you say, oh, this is a nice flourish that I can put on there?
I do tend to plan, and it's helpful to kind of know where you're going for me in my work. And so I do design my novels over a multi-year time frame before I start to write them. The short story is the same kind of thing. It just is less time. I might be designing a short story over a year or a period of months so that I kind of know everything that's going. So I usually do know the final sentence, even if it is going to be a reversal of some kind.
And how much of the stories that you did over the past 10 years for this collection did you have to go back and re-edit and re-look at?
I did. I am always a reviser. And so some of these stories, well, the biggest example that you're talking about is when I wrote the original Eve in Hollywood after Rules and Civility was done, which picks up, as you said, with when Eve disappears in Rules of Civility. She's on a train headed home to the Midwest. She doesn't get off the train where her parents are waiting and instead extends her ticket to Los Angeles. And that's all we kind of know about what's happened to her in the story of Rules of Civility. So Eve in Hollywood picks up where she's on the train. And there's a retired homicide detective, sitting with her, and he sees her extender ticket, and he's fascinated by this. And that's kind of where Eve in Hollywood begins, with this observation. And that original piece was 60 pages. And when I finished collecting the stories for Table for Two and handed it in, the minute I handed it in, I was like, I got to get it back. I'm not, you know, because I wasn't done with Eve yet. And I knew more about what was going to happen to her in Hollywood. So I took that 60 pages, and in the, you know, a year before that book came out, I expanded it to about 220 pages. I actually flew to Los Angeles, moved into the Beverly Hills Hotel, which is where Eve lives, and began to sort of tell the story, do justice to her story in Hollywood.
If you're just joining us, listeners, we're talking to Amor Towles, the author, and we're speaking about his new short story collection out now called Table for Two. And Amor, I want to dive into Eve a little bit. You said there was something nagging you about where you left that character. Can you put a point on that? What was nagging you?
And I mean, your description of her earlier was, I think, exactly right. She is sort of a vibrant, charismatic character. She's also very willful. You know, you can tell she's a kid who would have never done what was asked of her or expected of her. If you expect something of her, she'll do the reverse just to make a point, you know. And so I really loved her as a character. And so when Rules was done, I really thought, okay, I've told you everything you should know about Katie. I've told you everything you should know about Tinker, but the two other main characters. But I kept thinking, what is going on with Eve? And so that's what prompted writing that initial 60 pages. But then I was still, as I was saying, like, not satisfied that I wanted to really let her have the reins for a while, you know, as it were. She's the secondary character in Rules, and I wanted to put her in the driving position because I do think she's such a fascinating personality.
And so you checked yourself into the Beverly Hills Hotel, and that's part of where the story takes place. Like, tell me why. What is it about being in that space?
It's the sacrifice that we make for art. It's a beautiful place. It's partly because the change of temperature. And, you know, just walking through the hotel, let's say out back, one of the stories opens at the pool of the hotel. Walking there and passing sort of the smelling orange blossoms. It's such a crazy thing to be in California in the middle of what is our winter and to smell very fragrant, beautiful orange blossoms. And so you're there partly just as a reminder of that. And then that kind of changes your mood too. You know, living in a place where you're smelling orange blossoms in February, it's a different kind of thing than waking up to cold and rain. And so it sort of lets you tune in a little bit more to what the characters might be going through.
Another element of that story, I think, is the noir genre,
yes,
which I'd love to dive into. Yeah. Are you a fan of the noir genre?
I am. And I like to think of it as, if you think of jazz, it is a uniquely American art form. You know, only it could have been made really in America, but then was adopted or admired around the world and has been sort of interpreted around the world, whether in Asia or France or what have you. And noir is another version of that. It's an art form that was really invented uniquely in the United States, is loved around the world, has been interpreted both in writing and in film by great writers and filmmakers across Europe, in Asia. So as someone who loves American narrative, of course, I'm fascinated by noir and the way it's built, how it operates, what it sounds like. And as soon as I realized I was going to tell a story about Eve in Hollywood in 38, I was like, oh, this is a perfect chance for me to sort of dip in and approach the noir genre from my angle. And with a female heroine, and that would be a sort of a fun way to sort of explore that tradition.
I love that you say that there is this great American tradition of jazz and noir, because, yeah, correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like jazz is always in noir. Like,
yeah, well,
the two kind of
true.
Go hand in hand. It's really interesting.
It is true, yeah.
What are the other elements about noir that really get you as a writer?
You know, one of the things that I think, you know, we all sort of love is sort of the hard-edged observation quality of noir. And, you know, if you go back and read the novels of Hammett or Chandler or Ross MacDonald, the main heroes are people who are willing to be sort of look at the world with a cold eye. They have low expectations for everybody. You know, they assume everybody's playing a double game. They assume that nothing is going to probably be fair, you know, but they're very shrewd observers at the same time. And they can be sympathetic, even though they have sort of this cold-hearted view of the world, because they are the heroes of the detectives of the noir generation, noir genre, tend to be honorable people, but it's honorable around their own personal code. And so part of the fun of noir is sort of beginning to understand what is Sam Spade's code? What is Philip Marlowe's code? And what are they going to abide by? And because they don't live in a lawless sort of mindset, even though they know everybody's cheating and lying, you know, including potentially themselves.
Right.
And so they sort of have all those kind of qualities that that are fascinating from when you're trying to think about narration. You know, and from a point of view, is how is that going to be infused into this world that Eve arrives in?
And how much of that process of finding a character's moral code comes from just writing and rewriting and digging in? And how adaptable do you have to be? Because it feels like that would define the entire character for the story.
Yeah. It's a great question, because I think if I think about storytelling for me, whether in novels or short stories, figuring out what the story is going to be about, where it's set, who's in it, when it takes place, that's stuff that comes to me pretty quickly, mm-hmm, when I begin the process of imagining a story or a novel. The hardest decision, and in many ways the most interesting decision, is going to be the narrator. Is who is the narrator? And you know, that is two parts. It's what's the point of view of the narrator? Is it an omniscient narrator? Is it the main character? Is it a sibling or a spouse? Or is it an observer who's a stranger who, you know, is watching these events unfold? So what is the point of view of that narrator? But then what is the tone? Because you could take that point of view, that individual, that's, you know, spouse, let's say, and that spouse could be angry, the spouse could be deceitful, the spouse could be compassionate. You know, there's an emotional content there, an intellectual content that will shape the tone. So all of those decisions have big influence on shaping the story that I'm going to end up writing and the story that you are going to end up reading. And so going back to that sort of question, yeah, choosing in this, because in Eve in Hollywood, it's actually told from seven different perspectives. Mm-hmm. And each of the perspectives has its own tone, its own sort of point of view, its own perspective. So therefore, it has to have its own language, its own sort of tempo, its own sense of poetics, and its own sort of moral standing, mm-hmm, you know, because each of those characters looks at the world slightly differently. And so that's part of the fun of it, because you end up with this tapestry of points of view at that time.
Yeah, there's so much going on. And speaking of how you tell the stories, there's more stories to get to in this book, and I want to get to them. We got to take a short break, but we're here with Amor Towles, the author, and we're talking about his new short story collection, which is out now. It's called Table for Two. This is all of it. We'll be right back. Stay with us. This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Kushan Avadar in for Allison Stewart, and we're talking live in studio with Amor Towles, the author. Just came out with a new short story collection called Table for Two. Lots of great stories in here, Amor. I want to get to the first one, which is The Line. The first story in this collection follows a peasant named Pushkin who comes to Moscow with his wife, Irina, following the Bolshevik Revolution. And, you know, you read this story and you don't need to try too hard to see the connection to a gentleman in Moscow. And I was wondering, both the count from A Gentleman in Moscow and Pushkin in this short story, they ooze charisma off the page. And one thing that I really like in this writing is the sense of atmosphere and the sense of just charisma of sitting with a character. This is going to be a tough question.
Okay.
But how do you write charisma into a character?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because I do think that, and I think a lot about charisma in writing generally. So I think that sort of an underappreciated aspect of what makes a book great for us as readers is that it has to have an internal charisma. Mm-hmm. And the charisma can be in the personality of the characters. It can be in the language of the story is told in by the writer. It can be through the imagery. It can be the sort of the thematic urgency. But there has to be something that makes it sort of stand out from all the millions of words that we are exposed to in a given year. And so with the individual characters, I think that for me, one of the keys is I will spend a lot of time imagining that character before I start writing about the character. And that is sort of a loop where I imagine the character. I think I know them. I have some idea of what they might be like. But then I start to imagine them in situations with the other characters, let's say, in some circumstance. Mm. And through that, I realize, oh, wait a second. I thought I knew the character. I know these traits. I have a sense of their personality. But when I put them in that situation, I realize that they would do something different than I would have thought. And so then you're sort of like, oh, yeah, okay, I know them a little better. So then I kind of go back to the beginning of the story and start again and start to imagine the story. Now I have a richer sense of the character and eventually work up to another event that they're in. And then I learn something new and sort of they become and then I go back to the beginning again and start imagining. Because every time I get a little bit better sense of the character, the whole story has to change to some degree, as do its themes. And so slowly through this sort of iterative process, I hope I create three-dimensionality. And that, to some degree, helps bring the character alive. And I think that instills some charisma.
So that, to me, that process sounds like plot is, and this isn't pejorative, but plot is secondary. Like, plot is the result of putting characters you've really thought about in memorable situations. Do you always start with character first, or is there a plot that, you know, sometimes you think, oh, this is a beat that I love, let's center something around that?
I mean, I think you're kind of building, or I'm building the place, the plot, the themes, the characters simultaneously, but you're right that the character's at the center of the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Much in the way that I think if we think about our own friendships, our own relationships, or romantic relationships, we know events that have occurred in our life with that friend or that family member, but that's not the way that we start, right? We start by saying, that's my brother, and this is the relationship I have with him. And by the way, when we were 16, he stole my bike, that's right. That's plot, but that comes much later than in sort of in the way that we think about that individual or the way we would describe the individual. We start with, who is this person? And so I think it's very natural in storytelling to put that in the forefront too.
Absolutely. Whenever I'm interviewing somebody, the first thing that I'm always asking myself is, who am I talking to?
Yeah, right.
And then what have they done? Which I think is an interesting corollary there. If you're just joining us, we're talking to Amor Towles, the author. This is All of It on WNYC. We're talking about his new short story collection. It's out now. It's called Table for Two. 7 stories. One of them is a novella. Almost all of them set in New York. One of them set in LA. I want to go to the Carnegie Hall story.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because it's so funny because you just had a spot in our break for Carnegie Hall because Eugenie Kissin was coming. And that's the number of the stories in this collection start with a thing that happened to me personally. Not a big thing, but a small thing. And that the first 5 pages of The Bootlegger are probably the most autobiographical thing I've ever written. Mm. And it was in my early 30s, I read that Eugenie Kissin was coming to Carnegie Hall, coming to America for the first time in his life, viewed as probably the greatest piano player alive at the time, and maybe still. And I was like, oh, we should go. I convinced my wife, let's go. And so, we made a donation to Carnegie Hall. We got nice tickets. We went to the show and, dressed up, had a nice dinner. And we sit down, and the old man who was sitting next to us in a trench coat, I realized about 5 minutes into the concert, is recording the concert with an illicit tape recorder. And it drove me kind of crazy. And it bugged me so much that I remember very vividly the next day, I was like, I'm going to turn him in. You know, I was going through a fantasy of indignation. I'm going to, at the break, go get the security and they're going to arrest him or whatever they're going to do. I don't know what they do, you know. But I just kept thinking about it. And the next morning, the New York Times reported that at that concert, Kissin got one of the largest, the longest standing ovations in recent memory. And I don't remember anything that he played. I don't remember a single thing about it, you know, because I was so upset about this guy. So, but then, you know, a year goes by or 2 years go by, and I was like, you know what? I'm gonna go back to that moment. I'm gonna start there, and my character is gonna do what I didn't do. You know, he is gonna go get security, and we're gonna see what happens. You know, and he gets his just desserts, just as I would have. You know, but so that did come from a glimpse of my own life.
Was his moral code just yours, and then you just changed the plot right there? That character probably was pretty easy to come to. Right?
Yeah. No, that was a pretty easy one to write. Yeah.
How do you think about combing your own life for writing inspiration? I mean, we talked about a lot of this is set in New York, and you've lived here since the '80s. How much of it is autobiographical?
Very little. And you know, I mean, most of my writing, any of my novels, there's no real characters, none of it, very little of it's drawn from my personal life, but occasionally something will percolate up and I'll get fascinated by something and weave it in. I'm certainly like the music I like, the food I like, the art I like, the novels I like are constantly woven in. But for the most part, it is imagined creations rather than personal ones.
Yeah. And I think this is a pertinent question, especially given your story and your way into writing, because, and I'll ask you to say this, so you can tell it in your own words, but your first, you know, breakout novel, mid-30s, you were doing something way different before that, right? Can you share that a little bit?
I began writing as fiction as a kid, and I wrote it in high school and in college and in graduate school. But when I moved to New York at the age of 25 in the late 80s, I joined a friend of mine who had had started an investment firm. And 20 years later, we were still working side by side. And so I had a divergence from what was really my primary ambition, my love of writing, and had this terrific, wonderful career with great colleagues and great clients and a great practice. And it was a lot of fun. But slowly, I began to realize, man, if I don't write a book, you know, by the time I'm 50, I'm going to end up, you know, bitter and a drinker, you know, because it was my dream. And so along the way, I began writing fiction on the weekends, and I wrote a book over 7 years I didn't like, and then set that aside. And then I wrote Rules of Civility. And when that became a bestseller, I retired from the firm.
How old were you when that happened?
Oh, I was in my 40s.
Yeah. You're in 40s. Yeah. You know, one thing that really resonates me about your story now is how you decided to pursue your craft and the dedication it must have taken. And it resonates with me specifically because you're catching me right on the other end of a similar jump, actually.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I'm in my mid-30s. Yeah. And, you know, Wall Street for you, I think, is the tech industry for somebody my age right
now. Okay, yeah, right.
And for me, it was going from the tech industry into what I've always had my eye on and worked on the weekend since I was 10, which was basically hosting.
Which is this. Yeah, terrific. Exactly. Well, congratulations.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
Right? It feels good on the other side, right?
I mean, there's so much doubt. There is so much, like, what am I doing? But it feels like there's dedication in it too. And when I hear your story, it really resonates with me. I'm sure it resonates with a lot of people out there, no matter what part of life they're in, specifically because as you get older, and this is somebody in their mid-30s, so you might have more experience than I do, but it feels like the opportunity cost to make a shift gets bigger and bigger, and it requires a lot of grit and it requires a lot of passion. For you, how did you keep that alive?
Well, I mean, what ended up happening actually is I had a mentor who was a great American both novelist and nonfiction writer named Peter Matheson, and he took me on as a student, when I was 19 or 20, and became a friend and a mentor throughout my 20s. He was very disappointed in me when I ended up going to work on Wall Street. And one night at dinner, he said, "Listen, Amor, I got to tell you, I've watched generations of artists who go and work on Wall Street, and I got to tell you, there's something about that industry that it's interesting enough, or demanding enough, or pays enough that when they never come back. All the artists I've known have gone; they never come back. So I think you should consider your life as a writer over." Mm. And it was like my moment of, you know, Peter was my Jacob Marley shaking his chains, you know, and sort of saying, this is, you know, you are going to end up, you know, you will fail to fulfill your passion, your talent, on the way things are going. And so that really got me, that's what got me writing on the weekends again, you know, was really that, the threat of that he had outlined.
I think another element of that was how many different paths it is possible to take, right? I mean, for you yourself, there are so many smart people out in the world doing so many different things. And I wonder for you, if you could go back and know you were going to be as successful as you are now, would you change being on Wall Street and just go into writing as quickly as possible? Or has that experience helped you in many ways that maybe you could point to or can't even say right now?
It's so hard to go back and rewrite everything and to think, oh yeah, you know, if I had only done this, publishing my first novel or having my first novel published in my 40s, what I and having this career, it means that I've written fewer books than I would have liked, let's say. Compared to some of my peers or what have you. What the advantage it gave me is that by the time I sat down to write Rules of Civility, most of my friends in New York didn't even know that I wrote fiction at that point. You know, it had been kind of all forgotten. my parents no longer were thinking about it. You know, nobody who was writing, you know, well-known in my generation writing fiction at that time knew who I was. You know, that's for sure, you know. So there was no, and I wasn't doing it to make a living. I wasn't doing it to formulate my identity. What that meant was that when I wrote Rules of Civility, I could just do it for myself. And that would have been, I think, harder to have that kind of freedom at the age of 25 when I was getting married, needed to, you know, pay the bills, needed to impress my friends, needed to satisfy my father, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all those other things. Putting it off really allowed me to do it in full freedom.
Yeah, and you mentioned, for me at least, like financial footing is definitely part of it
too. Yeah, that's
pursuing
true.
This is difficult, like the arts in general. And I think that there is this kindness of looking back on oneself and being able to say at any point there is creativity, there's possibility there.
And for sure. And I've been a published novelist for 13 years, you know, so a little bit more than a decade. It's amazing what can happen in a decade.
Yeah.
Right. So as you say, well, you know, it's going to be harder at 40 than it was at 30, or maybe it's harder at 50 than it was at 40. But each time you've got a decade in front of you, one of those decisions, you can have no ability to understand how much your life could change or how much you could accomplish in just 10 years with, you know, an applied focus. And so you get to sort of look back and say, wow, you know, that thank God I made the shift, you know,
right,
because that was a well-spent decade.
Yeah. Planting the trees. And
absolutely. Yeah, that's right.
And, you know, so you spent a decade developing these stories for the short story collection now. And fans of yours listening right now will probably protest if I do not ask, looking at the years ahead, not to put on any pressure, but is there a new Immortals novel in development?
Yeah, I'm at work at a novel that I was designing over a period of years, but I'm into it now. And that novel opens in Cairo at the end of the Second World War and goes all the way to New York in 1999. But that's about all I'll tell you about that.
Well, we'll be excited to see it.
Thank you.
We've been with Amor Tolles, the author. We've been speaking about his new short story collection out now called Table for Two. Amor, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
NYC Now delivers breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. By sponsoring our programming, you'll reach a community of passionate listeners in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to learn more.